Welcome to your March 10th Committee on Rules. We have a number of bills with legislators, so we will try and accommodate you all as quickly as possible. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 858 and ask the committee administrator to tell us a little about the bill and have Senator Verger come on forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 858 requires space in the voter's pamphlet designated for portraits and political statements to include a disclaimer indicating that the state of Oregon does not warrant the truth or accuracy of the information provided therein.
Thank you. Good morning and welcome. Fire away.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm here today to submit to you Senate Bill.
I picked the right bill, obviously.
But to put a short disclaimer at the bottom of the voters' pamphlet position papers, this is a very simple bill, but it is an extremely important bill. It's not a bill for you and I. It is a bill for our constituents, the public which we serve. The problem was brought to my attention when I realized that the voters in my district were misled into believing that the information in the voters' pamphlet was verified by the Secretary of State's office for accuracy. This is an understandable misconception. The voters' pamphlet comes in the mail. It looks official. It has a government seal on the cover. It looks similar to other government documents that have been received in the mail. It is a natural assumption that the voters' pamphlet was prepared by the government and therefore has the authority of accuracy of the government. However, this is not the case. Only the top portion of each entry has been verified for accuracy. The rest of the position paper could have any information, misinformation, disinformation that the candidates or proponents and opponents of initiatives want. Most people use this space for their platform, but not always. The Secretary of State's office will fix misspellings and eliminate obscenities. They do not change any of the content, even if it is blatantly untrue, even if the text is not about the topic at hand. There is a disclaimer buried in the introduction of the voter's pamphlet. However, people do not read this section. It is vitally important that the voter's pamphlet do not tend to read this section. It is vitally important that the voter's pamphlet be created in such a way as to minimize any possible misconceptions. That's why I'm here to submit Senate Bill 858 to add a small disclaimer at the bottom of each position paper that states that the above information has not been verified for accuracy. We do have a minor amendment to the bill. The disclaimer as written now is too wordy for the nature of those that are reading it. Most people that look over the voter's pamphlet skim the document quickly in order to convey the information to them in such a way that they're more likely to read the material. It must be presented in a brief, concise, clear, and user-friendly manner. That is why we have an amendment to change the disclaimer to simply state the above information has not been verified for accuracy by the Secretary of State's office. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing this, and I'd be happy to take any questions. And I have some great people with me today to also testify on the bill, and I'd like to introduce Ted Kaiser, who has done the research on my bills for me this session. And so in case there are questions that he has, all right.
Thank you. Sarah Nelson, Senator Johnson.
For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I'm the senator from Senate District 16. I don't have much to add to what my good colleague from Coos Bay has already stated for the benefit of the committee. I think that we have a conundrum here, given that the voter's pamphlet has the officialness of the state of Oregon all over it, the fact that the candidate submissions must be absolutely accurate, and yet throughout the rest of the document we have the opportunity for all different kinds of submissions. And I think it's one of largely voter education. I was just sitting with Mr. Neal looking at the places in the voter's pamphlet where the disclaimers do appear, and I think that Senator Verger's bill And the intent behind this is to try to do voter education to make sure that not everyone who picks up what has the appearance, if not the reality, of an official publication of the state of Oregon contains information that is accurate and reliable or is disclaimed to not be completely accurate and reliable. And so I support the purposes of this bill to try to get educated voters with good material in their hands that leads them to draw accurate conclusions about measures and candidates, and anything that we can do to point out those pieces of the voters pamphlet that have not been vetted for accuracy, I think is useful and part of an informed, engaged electorate. So I'm here in support of Senator Berger's concept and Senate Bill 858.
Great. Senator Nelson.
Hi, my name is David Nelson, state senator from Northeast Oregon, District 29, and I, in the interest of time, I think this, the state or the position has been very well stated by both my fellow senators, and I'm in support of this bill.
Great. Any questions for our Senator Atkinson?
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Berger, for bringing this to our attention. I am really concerned with the last few words. It says, by the Secretary of State's office. I think that that could be construed to be political.
Not verified by?
By the Secretary of State's office. I like the part that says, the above information not been verified for accuracy. But I'm concerned that we're giving the Secretary of State another tool to be political with. Do you have any comments with that?
Actually, we added that later. We had it for accuracy, and someone questioned, I believe that LC questioned that and said that if it was just that way, if the amendment was that way, and that was the way we had it, that it verified by whom? And that was a problem. So we actually added by the Secretary of State's office. I hadn't thought of it being political, Tim.
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, my name is Teddy Kaiser, and I'm on staff of Senator Joanne Berger. If you notice, this is Senate Bill 858-2. We actually did have a -1. This states what you had said. The above information is not verified for accuracy, and left it at that. But we got a letter from Legislative Council that said that may not be entirely accurate because the candidate could have verified for accuracy. So they felt that it should say who hasn't verified for accuracy.
Sarah Atkinson.
Doesn't it already say in there who furnished the material?
It does.
And wouldn't it make more sense to make that larger? I mean, because that's, if it's some left-wing group or right-wing group, I take things with a grain of salt, but doesn't making that larger get to the same issue?
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, it does say that it's furnished by the candidate or the person who has written a position paper, but we have found that constituents have felt that even though it has been submitted by a certain candidate, it had been verified by the Secretary of State's office for accuracy. And this is really about transparency. It's about creating a document that does not give misconceptions that we have found in the constituents and the voters. So most people, you have to look at how people look at the voter's pamphlet. And there's kind of two various types of people that look at voter's pamphlet. You have people who go specifically to a candidate and read that material, or people that kind of scan and look at the pictures and read if they're interested. There's very few people that actually read the legalese and the introduction of the voter's pamphlet. And so they miss the disclaimer that's there.
Madam Chair.
Senator Atkinson.
Senators, are we not setting up a problem if now the Secretary of State or some group fills out, pays whatever the fee is, and takes out a panel in support of or against a measure and says the Secretary of State has verified these numbers as being correct, that if you pass, for instance, Measure 37, it's going to cost the state billions and billions of dollars, but this other one has not been verified by the Secretary of State's office, and it's not going to do any damage. You see the political...
Senator Atkinson, I would ask that Mr. Fred Neal come forward from the Secretary of State's office to answer that question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Atkinson, Fred Neal from the Elections Division and the Voters Pamphlet Supervisor. Senator Berger's bill only addresses candidate statements and political party and assembly elector statements, not measure arguments. Measure arguments are a separate part of OS Chapter 251. In fact, 251-265 now requires a disclaimer after each measure argument that is pretty much as the bill is introduced for candidate statements by Senator Verger sets forth. The printing of this argument does not constitute an endorsement by the state of Oregon, nor does the state warrant the accuracy or truth of any statement made in the argument. Senate Bill 858 is looking at candidate statements and asking that some disclaimer comparable to that be placed at the end of each candidate statement.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks.
So.
Any other questions, Senator Atkinson? You're done? Okay.
Or whoever. Why doesn't this have a fiscal? It seems in years past, any time we'd ever sneeze at the voters pamphlet, it grew a fiscal.
Thank you. Our committee, why don't you just please state that for the record?
For the record. Excuse me, I have a cold. For the record, we just got a statement of no fiscal impact yesterday afternoon, so that's not reflected in the SMS.
Mr. Neal, would you like to respond as well?
Yes, Madam Chair, because of the conversations I had with the fiscal office yesterday, the bill as introduced would add about a half inch of space to each half page that a candidate is allowed. Some candidates now by statute, in the statute preceding to 125, they're limited to 325 words and no more than 30 square inches. 125 says on each allotted space of the voter's pamphlet, we've got to print this disclaimer, and we also now have to make some accommodation for 325 words plus this information furnished by. Where a candidate has deemed it necessary to utilize all 325 words to state their qualifications and their platform, and it has created a formatting issue for us, we've just tried to reduce the letting or the margins and cram as much of it, cram it all in without cutting words. And so this does create, I think, the briefer disclaimer in the dash two amendments is going to create less of an issue for us in regards to production, but we can't really take more than half a page, or the opponent candidate in the next column is going to be somewhat aggrieved by usurpation of their space because they had a shorter, pithier statement. It's not a fiscal impact. We hope it is perhaps a production issue.
It's a white space impact, though,
yeah.
Madam Chair, because I like white space in my voter's pamphlet.
Well, Senator Atkinson, you are a man of few words. I ask that you choose them wisely. Senator Farioli.
Madam Chairman, I think that the purpose of the bill is a wise purpose. I think that there is a possibility for individuals receiving the voter's pamphlet in its current format to believe that there is some truth in it. And I'm sure occasionally that happens. But the disclaimer seems to be a good idea, but I'm not sure that we should cite the wise and powerful Oz as the repository of all fact-checking ability in the universe. Simply the statement that the information contained in the candidate's statement has not been checked for accuracy would be much more inclusive. And people should be aware that this is political speech and protected by the First Amendment and not necessarily subjected to the usual and customary accuracy issues. It's a lot of it is opinion. So I would just suggest that the disclaimer ought to be very simple, very straightforward, printed on the bottom of every page, and simply say that the candidate statement has not been checked for accuracy.
Mr. Neal.
Yes, as I understand counsel's concern is that with the dash one amendments is that the candidate herself has certified the required information as being truthful, subject to felony penalty for false swearing. And to not say that, to add the third party verification is suggesting that the candidate hasn't verified her own information for accuracy?
Senator Verger.
Madam Chair, thank you. An asterisk would take care of that. Just a little asterisk with the information below just says to the reader, anything below that line has not been verified for accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
So that indicates to the reader that everything above that line is accurate.
Madam Chair, and follow.
Senator Verger, did you want to respond? Senator Farioli.
Thank you.
Does the Secretary of State actually verify the date of birth of all the candidates?
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, for state candidates, we verify their qualification to be a candidate in that electoral contest through the elections office of their county of residence. We don't, so we verify that they're a registered voter and that they reside, state that they're of a certain age, if age is a qualification for the office, through the date of birth on their voter registration card. But otherwise, no. And we state pretty much that on page one, page three, the first page, general information page of each voter's pamphlet, that the information required by law has been certified by the candidate, and that candidate statements are printed as submitted by the author, and the only changes made are attempts to correct spelling errors if the word is originally submitted isn't in the dictionary.
I'm going to push back. Because of the fact that the candidate does verify the statement, you have to have an actor in that particular sentence to determine who has not done the verification. If the Secretary of State is not appropriate, then you need someone else. Committee staff suggested by the publisher. But you have to have some actor in that particular sentence. I'm sorry. So, Senator Ferrioli, if the Secretary of State is not appropriate, folks need to come up with another actor in the sentence. Senator Shields.
Yes, I've been thinking about that other actor, and I would just like to ask a question. Actually, I had an earlier question about whether you're able to find birth dates for people as old as Senator Nelson, but that's an irrelevant question.
Records lost.
Yeah, it's lost in ancient archives before written history and all that. But the serious question is, as you were talking about these six words verified for accuracy, you know, by the Secretary of State's office, did you think of the possibility of just saying verified for accuracy by any state office, just three words, any state office, or if you wanted to be more inclusive, any state or county office, five words, any state or county office? That takes care, I think, of Senator Atkinson's concern. Any state or county office. Have you thought about that?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I actually just wanted the most simple statement.
Right.
It hadn't been verified by accuracy, and I actually like what Senator Ferrioli said, that the candidate statement hadn't been verified by accuracy. What I think that I'm trying to do is make it very transparent. Number one is that this is not an official state document with a good housekeeping stamp of approval on it. And as time goes on, most people do use that particular section to state their platform. However, that is not what they have to do, and they can say anything in that section that would be detrimental. And I know in my district, and maybe it's unusual, but a lot of people wait until the voter's pamphlet comes in and use that when they mark their ballot. And so I think we need to be concerned about that.
Follow up?
Senator Shields.
Having said anything you said, but given the feedback you've gotten from the Secretary of State's office, would you be opposed to something like the above information has not been verified for accuracy by any state office or any state or county office? Would you be opposed to that?
I wouldn't be opposed to it. I just think the simpler the better, and whatever the committee feels would be the best amendment, but it does need to be very simple and clear at the bottom of the page.
Follow-up, Madam Chair?
Sure, Senator Shields.
Mr. Neal, do you have any problem with saying something to the effect of any
state
or county office or the state of Oregon?
Oregon has not verified the statement for accuracy.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, certainly I would leave it at the state of Oregon. I just was going to look at the county voters pamphlet statutes, and I know I have some county voters pamphlet publishers behind me here that we'd like to have some parallel construction for their provisions, and I've been asked by staff to suggest also it'd be nice to have the same disclaimer for measure arguments that there are for candidates, so that you're not getting a different message in one portion of the voter's pamphlet versus another in regards to disclaimer. in the Secretary of State's voters pamphlet bill, it's primarily funding purpose, but it also has a provision to eliminate putting that disclaimer at the end of each measure argument because it takes up an amazing amount of space, and have one single disclaimer at the beginning of all measure arguments, the measures portion of the voters pamphlet. In the general election, that's a separate volume.
Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to drill into this just a little bit further. I think there's a really good principle here that we ought to try to uphold. But I'm still at issue with whether or not and to what extent the Secretary of State does verify the information on a candidate statement. And I use the example of age because it strikes me that there was a circumstance where a candidate did misrepresent their date of birth, and they had done that inconsistency with driver's licenses and other documentation. But the Secretary of State would never go so far as to ask for a birth certificate. So the information really isn't verified. What we rely on is the statute of requires that the candidate take responsibility for misstatements of material fact, and those are actionable by third parties or the Secretary of State. So I'm of the opinion that really nothing is harmed by indicating if the Secretary of State does not verify the information that the candidate does that. But to try to parse this thing to a place where I think we could go, if we simply said something like the candidate's statement has not been verified for accuracy, you could also use the same language for measure summaries. Arguments in support have not been verified for accuracy. Arguments against have not been verified for accuracy. So you've got a consistency of the disclaimer on all the things that are there, and I think you've actually created a misimpression if you say that the Secretary of State does verify information above the candidate statement. I think you do verify whether there's eligibility for the office, but if you're not looking at birth certificates and so forth, you're not really verifying the accuracy of information.
Senator Farioli, I'd be willing to go along with that particular statement, but it is inaccurate. What you just said is the candidate's statements are not verified for accuracy. That is not, in fact, true. Hopefully, most candidates review their own statements for accuracy because they could be held criminally or possibly civilly liable for what they say in the voter's pamphlet statement. So you could say candidate statements are verified by the candidate but no one else for accuracy, but I think that would be extremely wordy. So I think the question is whether we want to refer to the state of Oregon, whether we want to refer to a particular elected official, or whether we want to include the counties, the elections division as well, because some folks might believe that the county elections divisions are the ones that verify these statements. So I want this, I need help from this panel if you folks have any particular feelings about which direction should we go. But we need to have an actor in this sentence because of the fact that the candidates and hopefully the folks that prepare the ballot measure statements do verify those statements for accuracy. Any thoughts from the panel?
Madam Chair, the devil is often in the detail. Mm-hmm. And I think that the wording must be as transparent as the disclaimer itself.
Correct.
I need to probably make this disclaimer, and that is I have not worked with the Secretary of State's office on this idea or concept. I simply feel that after the voters in my district widespread seem to have a totally misconception of the voter's pamphlet, I'm concerned about that, and I think they need to know. So the exact wording on it is I leave to lots smarter people than I am. The concept is what I want, and that's where I want to be.
And I think we have total agreement in terms of the concept. So, Senator Berger, my question to you is, who do the voters in your district think produces the voter's pamphlet?
They believe that the state of Oregon
produced
this voter's pamphlet.
Thank you. Okay. Any more questions for the senators? I know, Senator Nelson, you're here to testify on another bill, I believe.
Am I?
Senate Bill 564? Okay. We're going to set you three free. We look forward to seeing you later. Thank you for this very interesting conversation. Is there anybody else wishing to testify in Senate Bill 858? Okay. I'm going to, unless committee members have any further discussion on this, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 858 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 564. Ms. Newingham, do you wish to come forward or someone else? If you have some other friends that want to come forward, that's fine. I don't think Senator Nelson will mind.
My name is David Nelson, State Senator from Pendleton, Senate District 29. This bill is a bill that's been requested by the clerks to clarify some issues, and since they are the true experts, I'm just going to, in the interest of time, I'm going to turn it over and say, Dave, what is the concern, and where would you like to go with this?
Thank you. Great. Thank you, and welcome back.
Hi, I'm Annette Newingham, and I'm from Lane County, and I'm on behalf of the Association of County Clerks. I'm the Elections Legislative Chair. We are, obviously, this is in support of this bill. We asked, Senator Nelson introduced this on our behalf. Current law actually has it so that a member of each precinct, there's so many precincts, there's for every 500 registered voters in a precinct, they can elect one member of both a female and a male in every precinct within a county. And we've been doing this for, as far as I can remember, it's been a long time. And this is on behalf of the parties with both the Republican and the Democratic Party. Historically, the majority of the precinct committee people positions are uncontested. And at the primary election for the 2004, there were over 7,850 positions statewide. That's both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. For 15,700 open positions, with less than 1% of those being contested races. So we really infrequently find contested races on the precinct committee. People. 64%, there's no candidates that even file for the open positions of all those 15,000 plus. About 4.8% are elected by the write-in process that actually successfully qualify and accept the positions. The statewide county election expense, including the contest, we have estimated to be over $185,000 statewide. It may not sound like a large sum statewide, but this does come out of general fund expenses. This particular bill, the overview on it, it provides language for the county clerk to place only the names of those precinct committee people candidates on the ballot that exceed the number of positions available, which we term as contested races. It eliminates the write-in options only for those uncontested races. It provides language for the county clerk to declare qualified candidates who filed for the uncontested races to be elected to the position without being placed on the ballot. So it has language so that they would be elected, because we do recognize that the parties, it's important for them to be elected at those elections, and in particularly when they're filing for the office. So they wouldn't be placed on the ballot, but there's language that would say that they would be declared elected, and it would be equal to actually going through the election process. It also provides for language that those declared elected for uncontested races be treated the same as a candidate elected on the primary election, which is kind of what I said. And for those positions which no candidate files, the position is considered vacant, and the parties can be appointed to fill the vacancy, which currently is what would happen in between the primary elections. I kind of give a little bit of an example with the two contests, because there was a little bit of confusion with the bill initially, and that's why you have the amendments. And when the Legislative Council drew it, they thought that they had to take the gender portion away. That was never our intent to try to do that. So that was restored with the amendments. And, for example, in the example that I gave, if you had a vote for four and the female contest had five candidates that filed for it, that would be a contested race that would go on the ballot. And if on the other one, let's say the male contest for that precinct, you had four candidates that filed or less on a vote for four, then they would be automatically elected as a result of that, and a certificate would be provided to that effect within the 10 days. Eliminating the requirement to place uncontested precinct committee positions on the ballot would eliminate all associated costs to typeset, proof, and tally write-ins for those uncontested positions, substantially reducing the added expense. The Oregon Association of County Clerks does urge your support of this bill.
Thank you. Senator Shields.
I was trying to follow you pretty well there, but I'm not sure I understand what the total savings would be from various sources.
Okay. I've attached a couple of things. One is the first two pages. One is for the on the Democrats. It kind of gives an outline by county, the amount of positions they had, how many contested races, how many successful write-ins, and the percentage. I have it also for the Republican Party. On the very back side, there's also the cost by county. It has the majority of the counties are included in this. The cost is really going to vary a little bit to county. Some counties actually print a separate precinct committee people ballot and do kind of a slate to try to reduce costs. In my county, I actually place it on the ballot. What it does require is that you have to have, because it's basically a district with every precinct, you have to have a unique ballot style for every single precinct. My county, I had over 400 ballot styles as a result of that. So it creates higher expenses and more proofing as a result of all the complexity of the election, because you have to have one party ballot for every precinct for the Democrats, one for every Republican, and if they open up either party to the nonpartisans, they cannot include precinct committee people, so you have to create another style on top of that. So it adds a great deal of complexity to the election for many contests that are not even there's no contest on it.
Madam Chair,
Senator Schultz.
The reason for asking the question, I'm sorry, I hadn't looked at the sheet that you handed out, but was it, as you describe it, it sounds like potentially a lot more than $182,000 when you factor in all kinds of variables that I don't think you can factor in. So, Madam Chair, my point is I think the savings are significantly more than that $182,000. I have some concurrence from county clerks and elections officials behind you.
Senator Shields, Madam Chair, yes, I would probably agree. It's very difficult for us. We did our best to try to come up with a cost, but what you're doing is you're creating an election, and you're doing multiple functions at the same time, and you're trying to extrapolate what portion of your time you're spending on just that, and that is actually quite right. It is difficult to extrapolate that, and we tried to just give a conservative so that we didn't overestimate.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Farinelli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is a good idea. I've talked to the county clerks about this, and I kind of pushed back on them on a concept basis. How can you have an election with no elector? How can you have an election without a ballot being cast? And their argument was, but it's $182,000 that we're printing all these ballots that essentially you may have one vote on them or none. And in fact, there are cases where precinct committee people have been nominated and no votes cast, and they've been elected because they were on the ballot. So I guess I'm going to have to ask you, how are you going to make the connection between the elector who must cast a ballot for an office to be occupied and the certificate of election, which indicates that we had an election and a ballot was cast and counted and the individual was elected? How do we make the connection without actually having any votes cast?
Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, the language was run through the Legislative Council, and in the Senate bill, it actually talks about specific language on sub 4 on line 24, the first page of the bill. It says for purposes of the ORS, you know, the specific ORS, a candidate declared elected under this section shall be treated the same as a candidate elected at the primary election. I would believe that legislative council thought that this was would hold through, that they would be considered elected and could be. Now, the parties have their own individual rules as well. So it would really be the individual, you know, the, both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party to take a look at their bylaws and if they needed to change them to make sure that that was not in conflict. I think that would be certainly wise. I don't proclaim to have complete knowledge on that.
Senator
Farrelly.
So it actually would be the party's responsibility for the declaration. They would do the declaration of the primary winner, and if it is an uncontested election, at that point the Secretary of State would be free to issue a certificate of election. So the party would actually be the determiner of the elector.
Madam Chair and Senator Farrelly, I'm sorry. Yes, absolutely, because in all cases when the elected officials certify an election, they do not determine the whether individuals qualified. The districts would do it. In the case of this, the parties ultimately are the decider. We would just be the ones issuing the certificate once it was established that they were qualified. And also to clarify on a previous point, currently they do need to they require three votes in order to be elected, and that would be taken out that language to make that possible for this change.
Senator Farrelly.
That answers my question.
Okay. Senator Atkinson, you
have a
question?
Yeah, I have a couple.
Looking pensive.
What?
Looking, apparently.
Have both of the have the numerous parties been contacted on this? Democrats, Republicans,
Unions? Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, yes, we have had contact with them. Actually, 2 years ago, last legislative session, we contacted both the Republican and the Democratic Party on this, and have had been in discussion to kind of discuss this issue. At that time, Marion County Clerk Al Davidson contacted the Republican Party, and I was in contact with the Democratic Party. We've had conversations numerous times this session as well, trying to talk to find out what the concerns were, because really what we were trying to express is that we in no way wanted to make this a problem for the major parties to have precinct committee people, because we understand the importance of that for both parties. So we wanted to have a win-win situation that would assist us in what we're trying to do for them, and at the same time try to reduce costs.
So both parties, both major parties and some of the minor parties, have endorsed this bill?
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, I don't know that they have endorsed it. I think that change is a very difficult thing. I think that this is the first time we've come up with a bill that there's language. I think they're hesitant to, because there's some people that probably the change is scary. They want to make sure that they can do what they need to do. But we have not also had opposition. It's just kind of like they don't want to be the pioneer for this change.
Well, could we get some kind of indication from both or from some of the parties? The reason I ask is I look at down here at the second bullet point, eliminates write-in option for those uncontested races. I'm a little old-fashioned, but I think that I like the whole write-in process of letting people vote, putting names on. Young people get involved in politics, Democrats, Republicans. First time they see their name on a ballot, they're young and it comes in the mail and looks real official. And you know, and I know there's a cost associated with that, but there's also a culture associated with public service that, you know, running for office that. That's one thing I want to make sure we don't just throw away.
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, I certainly endorse the ability for people to be able to do the write-in process. What we do find in all reality is that it becomes frivolous, the write-ins that we see for the precinct committee people. People write in a name. Currently, they have to have three votes. We go through a very laborious process that is costly, and the majority of the people's names that are written down don't even qualify, nor do they even have sufficient three votes to be able to be elected. So this is the reason why we're bringing this forward, because we feel that there's a better way to do this and still accomplish what the parties need.
One last
question. Go ahead, Senator Atkinson.
This is to my Republican colleague, Chairwoman Brown, from her Democratic colleague, Senator Atkinson. We've both been written in from the other party in our elections. Right, and I know this doesn't address it, but you've got here not later than 10 days after the filing deadline, you will receive your qualification. Is there anything that's being done to speed up that timeline? I know that on my last time I ran as a Democrat to be written in, it took weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. Costs always expenses, but this was never brought to my attention that this is the reason why the write-ins didn't get taken care of because of the party process.
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, I do not believe that that is related to what your experience is. If you're talking about a write-in for something other than precinct committee people, then...
But this happens at the same time. That was my...
Well, all election officials have... Let me give an example. This Soil and Water District, we had a no candidate filed. We had, in Lane County, 13,000 write-ins for that position. On that particular position, it took days for a team of people to tally the names, and the top vote getter wasn't even qualified. The problem is it is very labor intensive. You have to find the ballots which have the write-ins, then you have to sort them by the different types. You have to hand tally those out, and it is very laborious. And we want to do that process for those that have really meaningful issues, like certainly for the other contests that are on the ballot, such as legislative and otherwise, that are extremely important. And it's not that the precinct committee people is not extremely important, but what we find is that there's not, like the Soil and Water, where you don't really end up with candidates as a result of the laborious process.
Ms. Nguyen, this bill sort of begs the question, Senate Bill 564, about why taxpayers should be subsidizing elections for party elected officials. Could you respond to that? That leaves me, frankly, more concerned than anything that Libertarians, Green Party, Pacific Party, etc., are all paying to subsidize electing of leadership, frankly, in the Democratic and Republican parties.
Madam Chair, that certainly has been a historical fact that we the counties have paid for the election for the precinct committee people. This is an attempt to try to reduce that cost to taxpayers out of the general fund. It is not a large sum, but it is a contribution that can be spent to other things. I can't really comment beyond that. That is more historical than anything else.
Thank you. Senator Farrioli.
Madam Chair, I understand the point that you just made, but I guess I would ask then, if that's the case, why are we issuing a certificate of election from the state of Oregon?
To precinct people?
Do we not do that?
No.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks. Any further questions? Thank you. Senator Nelson, you should feel free to stay or go, whatever. It's a very interesting conversation. I have one other person scheduled to testify on that one. Mr. Steve Druckenmiller? Did I get that right?
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thanks for joining us. Very interesting issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Steve Druckenmiller. I'm the Linn County Clerk, and I don't think I've ever had the pleasure of testifying before any of you, which is another way of saying that your good luck just ran out. I've been county clerk for more than 18 years. I'm my 19th year. And I've done elections in Linn County for going on 23 years. And this seems probably to you like a fairly small
Could I have you speak a little bit, please?
And what you consider here. But for us, especially those who have year after year, election after election, watched money spent in different ways that aren't particularly good, this one really stands out and has been very frustrating. And Annette mentioned that it comes out of the general fund, and for a large part it does. But if by chance a school district is on the ballot, or a water district is on that same primary ballot, some of those charges end up being paid for by those small districts. Cities, of course, don't pay, which is a terrible mistake. But it's really a wasteful issue on the expenditure of money. And aside from that, I really don't have too much more to add, except I try not to come back very often and inflict myself on you. But I do want to be fair, and you raised an interesting question about people coming into the process and the like through this. And there's some people that do like seeing their name on the ballot. The bill is not problem-free. But I think you've seen enough of them that you know no bill is. And there will be probably some detractors to this, but when you weigh it, when you weigh the cost, when you weigh the efficiency of the election process and the accuracy of it, I can tell you, if I understood your question, Senator Atkinson, it does slow down the writing process after the election. Because in Lynn County, I don't give out results piecemeal. When we do the write-ins, we do all of them. And so offices, for instance, what you're talking about, where you could not be maybe opposed on the other side, but you need to get write-ins to block a candidate, those results are slow in coming. And that is because of this. I'm also very cheap, but I would like to leave this with you. I didn't make 10 or 20 copies. And what this is, are the write-ins just in small Lynn County. All these pages. All of them. You'll see one, you'll see Minnie Mouse, Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck. These all represent ballots that we had to stop the election process and look at. We have an optical scan machine that when there's a write-in, it stops because we're going to check that ballot. It slows down our count. The cost is wasteful. And I will leave this with you to look at. You'll see that there's some large numbers here. And these are people that were on the ballot and were elected. But the other numbers, the ones and the twos, you'll see the waste of taxpayer money and time for the election. And this is only represents, now for each one of these precincts you see here, there's another page I didn't bring, which is the tally page that we do, where we have to by hand write out the candidate's name, mark the ballot for that one precinct. And if I brought that to you, you would see it's this high. Mostly for frivolous things. In Lynn County, in the last 21 years, I went back and I looked, we had 5 contested races since I've been there. And only the last one was just two people who didn't like each other running against each other. The rest were mistakes where they filed, they didn't know someone else had filed, and after the deadline, we couldn't take them off the ballot, but the loser could always be reassigned to a different precinct. So with all that said, again, I really appreciate you wanting me to inflict myself on you, and I will do my best not to appear before you again for a very long time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Great. Thank you. We have one. Before I close the hearing, is anybody else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 564? Okay, good. I could just close the hearing. We have one possible consideration of a drafting concept. I believe all members have it in front of you. Chair would open a public hearing and work session on possible consideration of concepts for drafting by legislative council. I believe you all have it in front of you with a memo attached. Measure 7, they do?
Mm.
No? Okay.
No.
Okay. If the chair would ask that, I'm gonna send this back through everyone. I think this is a request by the Hunger Relief Task Force to changes. I'm gonna pass that through and have everybody take a look at it.
Hunger Relief Task Force.
That's okay. And then we will go.
the humane guy. There's a website in Texas where you can see the animals on field. And there's a real gun on some mechanical control device. You can aim it.
Right,
you have to
read it to prove
the legislation. I've been on that task force for 10 years. I just wanted to take a close look.
And it's the
building.
The bill is to outlaw that.
Really?
Okay.
All right.
Really?
I think I made that up. The original was the technical defects of the bill because it had to do with remote control. And they said, well,
did you have to get a license, a hunting license in Texas for this? Do you hear about this bill?
Yeah, okay.
What is this?
Just yes. Yes.
Okay, oh, good to see it, Senator.
If you want to see it,
the Hunger Relief Task Force.
I've got Senator Shields reading every single word, and you all talking.
We're not talking, we're communicating.
Communicating, great.
Right. All right,
all right. The chair would move that we approve the request to draft the legislative concept for the Hunger Relief Task Force. Okay. Is there any discussion about the particular drafting request?
I would like to hear both caveats.
Both caveats are the chair asks for the vote simply for purposes of drafting and not or in support or opposition to the measure, and that by having this bill be drafted, we will not delay the session any further. Any further discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Senator Atkinson?
Yes.
Thank you.
Senator Ringo?
Yes.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ferrioli?
Aye.
Chair Brown?
Chair votes aye. Motion passes, and Chair thanks each of her committee members for their wonderful courtesies in approving this drafting request. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 992 and ask Senator Walker to come on up.
Madam Chair, I'm going to bring a couple of folks with me.
Sure. Before you testify, the committee administrator is going to tell us a little bit about this bill.
I always forget to ask my committee administrator to do that also.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 992 creates the position of the Executive Appointments Administrator to be appointed by the President of the Senate and the Senate Minority Leader. It would also eliminate the requirement of Senate confirmation of executive appointees to certain boards, commissions, and councils.
Thank you. Please proceed, Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator from District 7. And I find it interesting that we happen to have this bill up this week when you had a very contentious executive appointment hearing earlier this week, 2 days ago, as a matter of fact. I brought Senate Bill 992 to the legislature because I've been discouraged by the executive appointments process. That discouragement began well over a year ago now. And so I have brought with me Marjorie Taylor and Celia Nunez. Celia Nunez serves in our caucus office as a researcher, and Marjorie Taylor got involved in this because she was serving as the Rules Committee Administrator over a year ago, and I was pretty upset with the executive appointments process, so I went to Ms. Taylor and asked her for her help in doing some research to research in other states what their process is, and so I brought Ms. Taylor to answer some questions. What has got me so upset is I feel like we have three branches of government here. We have the executive, the legislative, and the judicial branch. But golly gee, it just seems like over the years that the legislative branch has become less of a co-equal branch. And this is a good case in point.
executive appointments, as you know, are often very political appointments. We seem to find that's true across the board in many states. The governor has the authority to make executive appointments, but the legislature also has the authority to confirm or not confirm those appointments. I'd like to give you a little history. I'm fascinated by history, and some people chide me for spending too much time in the archives building, but also our research librarian, Dave Harrell, is also very good at gathering research. Let me just give you some history about why in the Constitution the Senate has the authority to confirm executive appointments. And I'd like to take you back to 1977. I'm going to take you back to 1973. In 1973, Lee Johnson, who was the Attorney General for Oregon at that time, wrote a letter to former Governor Tom McCall, and he was very upset that this person who was up for an executive appointment was being met with so much resistance. And this person was Loren Kramer, and he was being appointed to the Law Enforcement Council. Lee Johnson wasn't happy about the objections that were coming from the Senate. And so Mr. John Powell, who is a lobbyist now, but who is a senator in 1977, brought forward a bill to this assembly, SJR 20, that went to the ballot and was approved by Oregon voters by a substantial margin the next year. That ballot measure put in the Constitution that we had the right to confirm executive appointments. And I'd like to read from you from March 15, 1977, Senator Powell's comments to the committee at that time. It was before the State Senate, the Senate State and Federal Committee. As I'm sure that you are aware of the arguments with regard to the Senate's confirmation authority, the issue was clouded by a letter dated December 5, 1973, from then Attorney General Lee Johnson to former Governor Tom McCall. The letter is of pre-Watergate quality, saying that anyone who has worked hard in government and on several committees must be qualified. And even more striking is the argument that, quote, now this will catch you all off guard, quote, I have also conferred with Mayor Goldschmidt of the city of Portland, and he is in full support of Mr. Kramer's reappointment, unquote. Obviously, Richard Nixon worked hard and served in several capacities as a government figure, and men in high places said they were in full support of him even to the end of his presidency. Those arguments against the confirmation process simply lack intelligence. That was Senator John Powell testifying in support of SJR 20 in 1977. As I indicated, that went to the ballot. It was approved by the voters, and we now have in our Constitution unfettered authority to confirm executive appointments. Also, the governor rarely uses this process. The governor, under the Constitution, or under the statutes, actually, ORS 236.140, any person holding an appointive office in any of the offices, departments, or institutions of this state shall hold the same for an indefinite term, not exceeding 4 years, and shall at all times be subject to removal by the appointive power which made the appointment. The appointive power may in all cases appoint a successor. This is interesting because the governor has the power to remove anyone he appoints. Anyone we confirm, the governor has the power to remove. So I would submit The governor does not use that power often enough, as we may see as I debate some issues on the floor this morning. Currently, the Senate confirms 116 boards, commissions, and agency heads. 30 of those are paid positions, and this measure proposes to delete Senate confirmation for 19 boards and commissions. This bill also would set up, as your administrator indicated, an executive appointments administrator. There's a cost to that, and that's to be determined how much we want to spend. But frankly, I'm tired of not getting information about these executive appointments. We have no independent counsel who does background research or does any kind of background information on the appointments that come from the governor. I don't care who's in the governor's chair, a Democrat, a Republican, or an independent. It is my obligation as a member of this Senate to review those appointments, not based on name familiarity or opposition to whatever they've written in the press. It is to look at their character, is to look at their service, is to look at their ability to serve in a capacity that unites Oregonians and doesn't divide them. And it is the opportunity for us to see that these people are well qualified. Let me tell you that currently there is a form, an executive appointments interest form, that the governor sends out, and there are 3 pages to it. But you only see 2 pages. The caucus offices are only provided with page 1 and page 2. And I submit the form is kind of useless. It doesn't tell me a whole lot anyway. It gives me personal data. It gives me employment experience and the person's interest in the appointment. It doesn't say ask detailed questions like the state of Michigan does, which I'll get to in a moment, about what this person thinks about the vision for this department or this agency or this board or the current issues of the day. The 3rd page of this appointment form is background information. Things asked are, have you ever been a defendant in a civil action? Do not include cases in which you are included as a nominal defendant with no potential liability, such as mandamus actions. Have you ever filed for bankruptcy? Have you ever been convicted of, or have you pleaded guilty to any crime or violation? They don't want you to include traffic fines. Have you been the subject of any professional disciplinary proceedings or any professional license or permit revoked or restricted? I'm going to ask you some other things. Your Social Security number, and I don't think that's important for us to know. But I think these are important things for us as senators to know. We don't have access to that. We don't really have access to anything that our caucus folks do not research for us or that we research on our own. I'm a research nut. When an appointment comes across that raises an eyebrow for me, I'll start digging around and getting as much research about this person as I can. I don't have time to do that. I submit probably most of you don't have time to do that, and that's why we should have staff doing that. In Michigan, in the state of Michigan, Ms. Taylor went on the web for me and downloaded this information. There's a questionnaire that's very, very lengthy, and this questionnaire goes on the web. Now, there are some things on this questionnaire that I would not want to see on the web for someone. Like they ask, have you had a mental illness? Are you being treated for a mental illness? Or have you had had an alcohol or drug problem? You know, there are some very personal questions that I don't really think, even as a candidate for public office, I wouldn't put in documents. That's not anyone's business. But there are many other things that the Michigan questionnaire asks. For instance, relationship to governmental employees. Are you or your spouse or other close family members related to any state government official or employee? I think that's important information for us to know before we confirm people to these boards and commissions.
Compensation. During the past 5 years, have you or your spouse or other close family members received any compensation or been involved in any financial transaction with the state of Michigan? That's important information. I want to know more than just that someone served in Congress and authorized cutting of timber, or, you know, or this person voted to support a ballot measure that certain folks didn't like. I want to know more information, and I deserve to know that, and so do the people of the state of Oregon. We also, there was an article in the Statesman Journal on Sunday, September 12th, Government at Face Value. Governor Kulongoski pledged to appoint more women and minorities to key agencies, but an analysis reveals a mixed record. And they go through of all the boards and commissions and whether we have really been careful about diversity, honoring diversity on boards and commissions. I know that I've objected to the fact that I don't believe we're doing enough of that. We've left it in the governor's hands to do that. I think if we take over a little bit of control over this process, we have an executive appointments administrator who does some more background research, who does some research into how many minorities and women have been appointed, and make suggestions to those of us in the Senate who are making these critical decisions. I think that's very important to do. And there was something else on my mind that I wanted to bring up. And Ms. Taylor, let me say that when we asked for this bill to be drafted, and I'm going to have Ms. Taylor explain to you some of the documents that you have in front of you, we wanted to repeal the requirement for Senate confirmation for specific boards and commissions because, frankly, colleagues, there's some of these that are just absolutely not worth our time. That is not to say that these are not important boards and commissions, because they all are. But yesterday in my Senate Education Committee, we had someone testify, the chair of the Workforce Investment Board, and I asked her specifically, I have a bill up tomorrow in Rules Committee that would do away with Senate confirmation of your board members. How do you feel about that? She said, I think that would be just fine. We have to meet federal requirements. There's checks and balances. I don't really think that it's important for us to go through the Senate. And frankly, I don't either. So we sort of took a stab at the list, and we wanted to keep Senate confirmation on those appointments that had fiduciary responsibility, the authority to appoint an administrator or license people, or who had oversight over the health and safety of Oregonians in the state. And I'll ask Ms. Taylor to sort of go through the list with you and give you a clue about the color coding and help you understand that. If I could, Mr. Chair.
By all means. And Senator, thank you for a detailed overview of the process. I appreciate it very much. Good scholarship.
You're welcome.
Vice Chair Farioli and members of the committee, in your paperclip packet, the very last document is the list of 116 boards, commissions, and agency heads that are currently required to have Senate confirmation. We've highlighted in green all of those positions that are paid positions, and in yellow, we've highlighted those boards and commissions that the bill proposes to eliminate from Senate confirmation.
I'll just pause for a moment, Ms. Taylor, and ask if all the members have their document in front of them. They do? Thank you. Please proceed. Senator Shields is holding his.
My question.
Yeah.
Senator Shields is recognized.
Yeah, I was looking at this earlier, and I was kind of. Of course, then I didn't know that the green are the paid positions. I hadn't thought about that. The yellow ones, as they jumped out at me, I was kind of thinking, are these the ones we weren't going to be, that are going to be eliminated? I'd arrived at that conclusion. But I was wondering what separates the ones that you've decided to eliminate from some of the other ones. You know, how do you, for instance, decide that you know, somebody on the Women's Commission could be eliminated, but you wouldn't want to eliminate somebody from the Trust for Cultural Development Board. I mean, what criteria did you use?
Mr. Chair and Senator Shields, as I indicated, the criteria we used were three. If they did not have a fiduciary responsibility, we eliminated them. If they did not have the authority to appoint an administrator or licensed people, we eliminated them. If they did not have oversight over the health and safety of Oregonians of the state, we eliminated them. So those are the three criteria we use. And truly, this was our first stab at the list, and this is by no means the final list. I wanted input, but we needed a starting point, and Mr. Chair and Senator Shields, this seemed like a good place to start. And I want to thank Ms. Taylor for spending her time last night color-coding all of these for you and providing you those documents. And I believe she also provided you the Michigan information. And I did find it, with the help of Ms. Nunez, the questionnaire I was looking at, and you can look at some of the questions. Like question 29 is, are you currently being treated for alcohol or drug dependency or other substance abuse problems? And then 30 was the question about mental illness. They also wanted to know if you were delinquent on your alimony and child support. And I don't think that's important. So,
Mr. Chair?
Question from Senator Ringo.
Thank you. I need to go in a few minutes, so I just wanted to ask a different question if I could on this. I want to understand the whole picture in a way that I guess I'm not right now, but this contemplates that this position you're creating shall seek the advice and assistance of interested persons, et cetera, et cetera. Then it says make recommendations to the Senate concerning executive appointments. You still envision that the governor is going to be nominating, and but this person is just essential to help vet that nomination in a way that's not happening now.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ringo, that's exactly hitting the nail on the head. We don't want to take the authority away from the governor. That's his right, his or her right. That is the right of the chief executive, and it should be. But we have a co-equal say in those appointments, and we need someone to help us vet those appointments, and that's what that's for.
Okay.
And then if I could, Ms. Taylor could explain to you a little bit more about some of these other documents that you have in your stack.
Vice Chair Ferrioli, members of the committee, again, in your packet, the first document was the executive appointments form that's submitted to the governor's office, and you'll see on page 3 that the background information that candidates provide to the governor's office is submitted in confidence. Therefore, as Senate members, you don't see that. However, you do see the first two pages, and any additional resumes or letters of support from interested parties. Then what we provided was a letter from Governor Jennifer Granholm of the state of Michigan and their application was submitted to the governor's office. However, the Senate Majority Office, as Senator Walker has been describing, they have a separate investigation and separate questionnaire that is provided to the candidates that have been forwarded by the governor's office. And all of this information is currently available on the Senate Majority webpage. And you'll see, as Senator Walker has been discussing, there's the first questionnaire. And then if the Majority Office has additional questions for certain candidates, they'll submit those questions and publish the response on the web. So we've included additional questions that were submitted to the candidate for the Department of History, Arts, and Libraries. So this just shows how in Michigan, although not required by state law or Senate rule, the Majority Office itself has taken on this additional task of finding out more information rather than just relying on the information provided by the governor's office.
And Mr. Chair, that's an important point that Ms. Taylor raises, and I want to thank her because it was through her work and her research that I got a very close look at how good she was at that sort of thing, and that's why I asked her to be my committee administrator for education, because I appreciate people who have that research capability. But she raises an important point. There's nothing really that's stopping us as a Senate from demanding more information. We can do that now.
We don't need a bill to do that. This bill just creates an executive appointments administrator that can do background research and help us draft these kinds of questions and be dedicated to that task. Now, that might not be a full-time position because we don't always have appointments all the time. It could be a shared position. It could be a part-time position. But if this bill doesn't, if we can't get that through this legislative session because there's a fiscal problem with it, I submit that there's nothing stopping us now from talking about this issue and creating forms and more things of interest that we could have people answer these questions. And this information should be on the web. Some of those questions absolutely should be on the web so that Oregonians really have input and don't have to rely on us 2 weeks after we get notice of an appointment and then everyone scrambling to try to get emails and letters of support or in opposition. So I think truly, there are things that we could do on our own now, but I would hope that I've piqued your interest in terms of exploring this issue a little bit further, eliminating some of these boards and commissions that we really don't need oversight on those appointments, and perhaps offer up this position of executive appointments administrator.
Senator Farrielly.
Madam Chair, thank you. I think you've got a good concept here. I got about three or four questions. One of them is, I think the purpose of running these appointments through the Senate, there's another purpose that may be unstated, and it's particularly important to those of us from rural areas. And that is, as we look at the population of folks that serve on boards and commissions, it's often and frequently that most of the folks come from the more populous areas of the state. And one of the reasons, as far as I'm concerned, to vet these things through the Senate process is that at least we get in the Senate the largest geographical representation of the state. All areas are represented. And it gives folks at least another opportunity to look at the makeup of the board and to bring the question, are we getting the widest possible representation geographically? Madam Chairman, the other issue for me is that I wonder if the senator would be interested in parsing the issue, meaning I can see a clear need for a better information conduit for the Senate, and I can see the need for that new tool. The issue of boards and commissions that might then not be subject to Senate confirmation, I'm glad to hear that the senator indicated that it's a beginning point, because I think there's an awful lot of discussion that needs to happen before mm-hmm. we could agree on which of these boards and commissions don't need to have Senate confirmation. I certainly see no compelling need for the Senate to be involved in confirmation of the TriMet board, for instance. And that seems to me not to necessarily to be a statewide issue. I would put into that category the Spinal Cord Injury Research Board and a few of those others. I'm not so sure that the Energy Facility Siting Council isn't one of those that rises to the level of statewide interest. So I'm glad to hear that there would be an opportunity for us to engage in the discussion of which of these things seems to have a broader implication and which of them you want to include the largest possible geographic and geopolitical involvement. So I'd love to be engaged in that conversation. I think that's a really good opportunity for us to talk about these boards and commissions.
Senator Walker, did you envision, I mean, my experience in working as the minority leader with the Senate president during the 2001 session was a fairly positive one. What happens if the president and the minority leader can't agree on who shall be appointed?
Well, that could be up for a vote to the Senate.
Okay.
Generally, that would probably fall along party lines the way some things do, but maybe not. But we could allow for that provision, Madam Chair.
Okay.
And then I also wanted to respond to Senator Ferrioli's comment. Again, good point. Research was done in 1984 by Alan Tresider, research analyst. I had no idea Mr. Tresider served in this building as an employee before he became a lobbyist, so look at the things we find. He was a research analyst and presented this to Senator Dale Isham on March 2, 1984. U.S. legislative research to compare the percent of state population in each county with the percent of executive board and commission appointees from each county. And so that is what this table shows, and that addresses your question about geographic appointments. And that's another area where this executive appointments administrator could be given that authority to track that kind of information to ensure that we have diversity on the board, both geographic, ethnic, gender, all of those things. And I just think it gives the Senate a greater tool and a greater role in this process than we currently have. Right now I just feel like a rubber stamp. And my rubber stamp says no, or it says yes. And beyond that, I feel like I'm not getting all that I need out of this process. And frankly, being in the Senate has its rewards in terms of the extra benefit of being able to confirm those executive appointments.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We appreciate all the hard work that you've done, that Celia Nunez and Marjorie Taylor have done on this issue. I think we'll let this percolate for a week or two and see what other feedback we get from folks, but very interested in see if we can't move this concept or something like it forward. So,
thank you, Madam Chair. I'm hopeful the two caucuses can have discussions about that with their members and see if there's some interest.
Great. Well, thank you very much. Seeing that there's no one else wishing to testify on this particular measure, I'm going to close the public hearing and adjourn for the day. Thank you.
Oh,